and welcome to the EU and You. I'm Ellen Gunning, and in this series, I hope to explain the EU and its most important institutions. Over the last 12 weeks, we've looked at the history of the EU, from the time of its beginnings as the Coal and Steel Union, right through to the present day. In week two, we looked at Ireland's membership of the Union, what it means for Ireland, why we joined, what impact we're having on Europe, what we hope to do in the future. In the third week, we looked at the structure of the European Parliament and learned how it had changed from being a parliament which was originally appointed by national governments to a parliament which is elected by the people and which now has much more powers than the European Commission. On the fourth week, we spoke to some of our MEPs. Sean Kelly told us what it was like to be a new MEP in town. Pruncius de Rossa gave us an insight into all of those derogations that we seek and how we use or misuse the time available to us. Jim Higgins gave us a fascinating insight into the Petitions Committee and how individual citizens can petition the Parliament and make a huge difference. Joe Higgins, the Dublin MEP, spoke to us about the rights of workers who are based in countries outside of the EU but with whom we have trade agreements. And Alan Kelly spoke to us about the rights of workers within the EU and particularly the Dell workers in Limerick. On the fifth week, we looked at broadly agricultural issues. Liam Aylward gave us an insight into CAP and particularly into GMOs. Nessa Childers spoke about her passion for food labelling. Mairead McGuinness talked about consumers' involvement in farming, rural life, rural issues generally. And Patha Cope Gallagher gave us a great insight into Ireland's fisheries policies and how it had changed from the time we joined the Union to the present day. On the sixth week, roughly midway through the series, we looked at the role of the Commission, what it does and how it does it. And in the seventh week, Commissioner Maura Geoghegan-Quinn gave us an insight into her role as Science, Innovation and Technology Commissioner. The eighth week, we looked at the Council of Ministers, what it does, how it revolves, how it will evolve in the coming years. And in the ninth week, we had Fergal Creehan telling us about how the Court of Justice is structured and put together, and Judge O'Keefe came in to talk to us about what he actually does as a judge of the European Court. In week 10, those two councillors from opposite sides of the country, Neil McNeillis, the Labour councillor from Galway, and Gerry Breen, the Fine Gael councillor from Dublin, spoke to us about what they actually did as part of the Committee of the Regions. Two entirely different regions that Ireland is divided into, two very different perspectives, one primarily urban on the Dublin side with Gerry Breen, one primarily rural on the Galway or Western side with Neil McNeillis. In week 11, we looked at the Court of Auditors. Emmanuel Schoen explained what their role is, what they do, how they make sure that our money is spent properly. And Owen O'Shea, Ireland's auditor, gave us some fascinating insights into what they've actually found, the monies that have been spent or misspent and have been recovered. Last week, finally, we looked at all sorts of financial issues. Teresa Reedy told us about the European Central Bank. Gay Mitchell explained what the European Parliament had actually done in terms of a very fast response to the financial crisis, the financial tsunami that hit Europe in recent years, and Marion Harkin lit a fire under every credit union member in the country. For this, the final week of the series, I wanted to look to the future of Europe, and who better to ask than our Minister for Foreign Affairs, Micheál Martin. Thanks for joining me, Minister.
You're very welcome indeed.
Let me begin with the most obvious question. When the whole concept of the European Union began, we were looking at six countries coming together to manage coal and steel and try and maintain peace. We've now expanded to 27 countries, and it looks like we could continue to expand. Can we realistically continue to include more countries within this grand European vision?
Well, first of all, I think, let's be clear, I think the question almost presupposes that enlargement has been a problem or a difficulty, whereas I see enlargement as an opportunity and as one of the success stories of Europe. And the enlargement has healed divisions in Europe, beginning, as you know, as you said yourself, with the post-war situation. But in more recent times, consolidating, if you like, the breakup of the Soviet Union and being in a position to absorb new countries, consolidating the freedoms that they won, and the development of liberal democracies, That is something that we should applaud. But of course, in addition to that, the creation of a market of over 500 million people, which makes the European Union a key global economic player, but also for a small country like Ireland provides a very significant market. In terms of the immediate future, you are looking at Croatia, possibly Iceland, and some of the Balkan states. And when I say the immediate future, that's within the next number of years, some early and some within the next 5 to 6 years. And that, in many ways, could be a stabilizing factor in the Balkans. And in fact, the EU perspective has in itself been a stabilizing factor in terms of the politics and stability of those countries. Clearly there's been a slowdown in terms of enlargement, but you will, over the next 20 years, see additional member states coming on board, not perhaps with the same rapidity as the last 10 years, but nonetheless it will occur.
I didn't mean to suggest that it was a negative thing, because I think the one thing that's been coming across throughout the entire 12 weeks is how positively everyone we have spoken to views the entire European concept. I suppose really what I was thinking of was more in terms of managing. The larger it gets and the more representatives you have and the bigger the parliament becomes, it must reach a point where it becomes unwieldy.
That's a fair point, and indeed that was the raison d'etre of the Lisbon Treaty itself, to try and create institutions that would give the capacity to deal with such a large union, and in particular to deal with 27 member states. And in fact, the European Council some years back have said that the pace of enlargement into the future must now take into account the Union's capacity to absorb new members. That is a very fair issue, and that's why there have been reforms to the institutions of Europe to enable it to deal more effectively and efficiently with a larger Union.
So without putting words in your mouth, is it fair to say that what Europe seems to be doing is saying we welcome more countries wanting to join us, we just need to find the right infrastructure that allows that to happen?
That the decision-making processes within Europe are such that they can be quick, efficient and effective, and that we don't, through the size of the union, if you like, make it too bureaucratic and clog up decision-making. That's an ongoing challenge. But as I said to you earlier, what we're looking at in the immediate future is probably, as I said, Croatia, the Western Balkan countries, and Europe has made it clear that the future of the Balkans lies within the European Union. You're looking at Iceland as well. Others would be a more longer-term horizon.
Let me bring you back to something else you said there. You mentioned the Lisbon Treaty, and one of the things that's come up in discussions over the last few weeks is that each time Europe obviously expands, and each time it needs to do something, it needs a treaty, an agreement among all of the countries. But the treaties in Ireland have always gone to a referendum. One of the points that was made by one of our speakers earlier on was that we don't always need a referendum, that it's an Irish choice to go to a referendum, and that maybe for the future we should look at, instead of those, you know, separate out the issues where there really is a very obvious constitutional change needed that requires a referendum, and maybe introduce a new mechanism. I suppose in light of the difficulties we've had explaining treaties to people, what do you think yourself?
I disagree, and first of all, I don't agree that the referenda have been held on the basis that the government's afraid of a challenge later. We've had challenges which have proven successful in the past.
Well, that's very interesting, because that point came across strongly in an earlier programme, that there was a feeling that the referenda weren't always necessary. So you believe they are?
Well, they are constitutionally, yes. And indeed, the last one in particular, the Lisbon, was certainly needed a referendum, and the Attorney General was very, very clear about that. So that's that point. And secondly, the positive side of a referendum is that it engages the people in a debate about Europe. And across Europe, many people feel that the institutions have become somewhat distant from the citizenry, or that the people don't have that immediate sense of the European Union in their everyday lives, or they feel it's a distant bureaucracy. The value of a full-on referendum, if you like, is that it creates debate in society, and people have to engage with the European issue and the division of Europe, but also you know, their pros and cons. And I think that's always ultimately, despite the fact that it might irritate people, it might annoy people, the bottom line is we are a democratic society, and we should ultimately be confident about our capacity to argue the advantages of the Union in the context of a referendum and through the power of debate. And ultimately, I think that's a healthier sign of a society than trying to circumvent, if you like, the will of the people, or to try and sneak something in the back door. Now, that doesn't mean all EU treaties have to be done by referendum. I mean,
I know,
for example, the accession of a new member state does not require a referendum under the Constitution. I don't expect any change in that. But on the broader issues, we do not see future governments doing away with referendums at all. I think the way you're speaking will go before the people.
Yeah, the way you're speaking, you'd almost welcome the opportunity to toss out the issues with the people.
I think I would. That's my genuine view, and I think we're the better for it. And even though we had to do, we had two referendums, we had to reform and refine. What was interesting after the first Lisbon Treaty was when we went back to Europe, many ministers of other states said, you know, maybe something similar would have happened in our country if there was a referendum. And also, the whole area of communications was prioritised to a far greater degree as a result of the first Irish referendum. And indeed, the issue about the Commissioner per Member State, for example, was one that had resonance across a number of Member States, and quite a number of states responded by saying, OK, we think there should be a Member State, sorry, there should be a Commissioner per Member State. So there's a healthier dimension to this as well that we should not forget. And I think if you take the last referendum now, I think a lot more younger people now, because of the referendum on Lisbon, are far more aware of European issues than they would have been prior to it. And that's a healthy thing.
Well, that has to be a good thing. Let me take you back to something else you said there too, that referenda actually makes the whole sense of Europe more immediate in people's everyday lives. One of the things that I'm just tossing at you from the series that we've done, but one of the things that came up when we were in Strasbourg was that the MEPs were saying, and I'm sure you'll dispute this, but the MEPs said that if there was good news coming from Europe, the government, any government, not necessarily your current government, but any government, would say, we've had this wonderful idea, we've introduced X. But if it was felt that people would react negatively to it, the government said, oh, nothing to do with us, it comes from Europe. I wondered, as we were talking to people, is there a case for, I know that MEPs have an opportunity to participate in committees in the Dáil, is there a case to be made for them becoming more closely interlinked with the Irish political system?
Yes, I don't have a difficulty with that. I think they are, as we speak, entitled to attend and participate in meetings of the European Affairs, European Scrutiny and Foreign Affairs Committees, for example. And MEPs can engage on those committees and have done so in the past. I discussed this issue in May with the Oireachtas, with an Oireachtas committee, which was reviewing the role of the Oireachtas in European affairs. And I said to the committee that they should seek ways in which the Oireachtas could strengthen its links with members of the European Parliament. And given that the European Parliament now has increased powers in deciding on European Union legislation following the Lisbon Treaty, you will actually see more engagement with European, or with the Irish members of the European Parliament. And I know that the committee on European Affairs met with a delegation of Irish MEPs. I know that ministers for foreign affairs are now engaging more with MEPs. And indeed, Cathy Ashton, when she was preparing the legislation or the proposals around the new External Action Service, made it clear to all foreign ministers that dialogue with national delegations and with the Parliament was essential to make sure that the co-decision process, which is the decision-making power of both the Parliament and the Council together, worked properly. And so I think you're going to see a lot more engagement with MEPs in the future as a result of that.
It's interesting that when we looked at the changes in the European Parliament, one of the biggest changes that has been made is the fact that there almost seems to be a shift in power, is probably the wrong word, from the Commission to the Parliament, but that you feel because the Parliament is now taking on more power, it almost encourages more interaction back with national governments, which has to be good from a voter's point of view as well.
Well, you're correct. It is a shift in power. The Parliament is now more powerful than it was. That brings with it responsibilities as well as, leverage. But it means councils can not take in any shape or form the Parliament for granted in relation to any issue. And indeed, the Commission can't either, or individual commissioners can't. So overall, I think it makes for a more dynamic process, and also for stronger and greater engagement, which I think is better for the citizen. I think the comments you made earlier are fair, that there has been a tendency to blame Brussels for certain laws that come through in the short term, in any event, whilst not giving due recognition to the impact Europe has had on on a better life here. And I think it's true in environmental legislation in particular. When environmental legislation is brought in initially, there's a lot of grumbling and complaints because it affects people having to change and so on. But move on 5 or 6 years and people look back and say, well, you know, the environment is better as a result of that particular decision. And Europe might get belated praise and recognition.
I think they're looking for it to be moved to the front of the house rather than to get the belated recognition. But
no, I'm just saying that's the reality of the past, and you're right, and I think that we have to change that.
You mentioned Catherine Ashton. One of the big changes that's come in recent months is that Catherine Ashton has been appointed, I suppose I would regard her as kind of Europe's foreign affairs minister. Somebody described her to me as the opposite number of Hillary Clinton in the US. I don't know that she's quite that. But I wondered, well, a couple of questions for you. One was, can Europe actually, delegate is the wrong word, but give over all of this power of spokesmanship and representation to one person in the area of foreign affairs? Because it's an area that every country has a slightly different perspective on.
Well, we're not giving it over to Cathy Ashton in the sense that Cathy Ashton represents the combined wisdom and perspectives of the 27 member states. So Cathy Ashton can't go to the Middle East and just articulate her own personal viewpoint. She has to implement European Union policy, and she has to articulate the mandate that she has. And that mandate is developed both at the European Foreign Ministers Council meetings and indeed the heads of state. So, for example, if you take the Middle East, mm-hmm. there's a very strong set of conclusions relating to the Middle East peace process, dating back to the most recent ones, the Swedish presidency in December. And Cathy Ashton works within that framework when she's meeting with Israel or indeed with the Palestinian Authority or indeed with other Arab states. And so that's the context. It's not a person having absolute power, but rather the person is representing a mandate and representing the combined wisdom of all the member states on key issues.
So very
what that
much
means,
like
though, is that you get a more coherent voice and single voice at international fora, which I think is better overall.
So very much like your own role that as Minister for Foreign Affairs, you could have a different opinion on something to other members of the government, but once the government says this is the government position, then your job is to articulate that position.
Yes, absolutely.
And is it likely then, if, because I think the whole idea of having one person who is a spokesperson on foreign affairs for Europe is a fantastic idea, is it likely that we'd see that expanded into environment and finance and other areas almost modelled on the lines of an Irish government or a national government?
A long way off. I mean, I think the Lisbon Treaty, in my view, there won't be a more substantive treaty again for another decade. I think we have seen a fair degree of economic convergence in the Eurozone countries, particularly in terms of the European Central Bank, in terms of the finance ministers, ECOFIN, which has always had a significant power and influence. But the Cathy Ashton position and the whole External Action Service is a work in progress, and it will influence developments in other areas into the future. But I think it'll be watched carefully in terms of how it evolves and how it develops. One of the main reasons advanced for Lisbon was to enable Europe to have that single coherent voice on key global issues. And the key global issues as we speak at the moment, certainly foreign affairs is an obvious one, but the climate change is another. And of course, the financial regulation and the fallout from the economic crisis. And all of that is leading to greater convergence in terms of the articulation of a European voice at global level. And it's happening on other continents as well. It's interesting in climate change, for example, and in my recent visit to Ethiopia, mm-hmm. I met with President Meles, who's the African voice now on climate change. And so to really make progress on these big world issues, and the climate change is a big one, you do need that sort of single voice approach.
It would seem to be an excellent idea, because somebody said to me that if you did it the old way, where with a revolving Council of Ministers and a revolving spokesperson every 6 months for foreign affairs, that over a period of a few years you could be dealing with 8 or 10 different people, all of whom are articulating the same position, but all of whom need to get a handle on their brief. So it would seem long term that it would be a great idea, even possibly in just those specific areas of sort of climate change and financial regulation. Let me take you down the finance road if I can for a minute, because one of the things when we were looking at finance, we looked at the role of the central bank. We looked at the role of the Central European Bank. We looked at the recent crisis. What we didn't discuss at all, and I'd be interested in your views on it if you don't mind, is this new move where member states are being asked to take a national budget and have it scrutinised in Europe before it's presented to their own national government or their own national parliament. And I just wonder, I presume the whole idea is that Europe offers advice and says, this is a good idea, this is a bad idea, this is keeping you within the budgetary framework or outside. Are we ceding an awful lot of power to Europe by doing that?
No. And first of all, it won't be done in advance of going to the parliament. But I think what all that member states have agreed to at the moment is to present their normal stability and convergence programmes about 9 months earlier than is currently the case. And we actually support that, because the purpose of that objective is to identify budgetary risks and trends more effectively and at an earlier stage. And I think that's useful for smaller euro area member states like Ireland. I mean, you really would call the situation with Greece when the figures didn't turn out to be correct in terms of budgetary figures. And I think Europe needs to be more robust in interrogating figures like that into the future. It's in all our interest. But there will be no detailed direction from Brussels, and there will be no ceding of budgetary control. The Dáil will still remain paramount in our budgetary process. And many, at the last European Council in June, many member states shared our position on the necessity, for the sake of legitimacy, that national parliaments retain their absolute central role. But certainly we have no difficulty with putting the macro position up front early. And we've done it already. I mean, everybody knows our objective is to get the 3% deficit by 2014. And that $3 billion of that is to be done in this budget. So Europe knows that now already. I think that's important, that Europe can plan appropriately going forward.
That makes a big difference, though, that it's the macro and not the micro. But they won't actually be involved in recommending on the specifics of the budget, just on the general thrust.
Yes.
Let me ask you something else, and I'm moving from one thing to another. I know it must feel like an exam from your point of view. When we look at the European Council, Van Rompuy, the new president, one of the things that had been happening in terms of the Council of Ministers was that they had been changing every 6 months. Ireland has come out of the whole process very well, actually, of handling the presidency. It looks like that's going to stop long term. If we now have a president of the European Council who's elected for 2.5 years, I presume the idea is that he would stay as president and that over time he would develop a civil service that would manage the presidency rather than have it rotating among the different countries.
Yes, I think what will happen is that there will still be the rotation of member state presidencies, but there will be a lesser role in terms of profile and so on for the member state because of the development of the concept of, or of the reality, sorry, of a president of the European Council. And Van Rompuy has, I think, fitted well into the role, and I think he has created a certain status already, and I think you will see long-term development of a strong position in terms of organizing, in terms of coordinating the agenda for the heads of state. And already he's talking in terms of 4 meetings a year now. It's been one of the most important decisions in the run-up to the Lisbon Treaty, the election of Herman Van Rompuy. I'm impressed by him, a very thoughtful man. I think his term will last until mid-2012. He can be renewed once for another 2.5 years, and I would suspect, I would bet that he will be. He has a small team of advisors at the moment. The council continues to be organized by the council secretariat. I think it's change rather than end in terms of the member states. So the rotating presidency will still have an important role. Because Cathy Ashton is also involved, she chairs the Foreign Affairs Council, and her staff will chair meetings of officials dealing with common foreign and security policy during her presidency. The rotating presidency, the member state, will then chair all other council formations and will set the agenda for the union's work.
So
we'll hold it in the first half. Ireland will next hold the presidency in the first half of 2013.
But it will actually reduce the amount of onerous work that the national governments are doing when they take over the presidency.
Yes, to a degree. Not to a huge degree, but to a degree.
No, it was one of the things that came across again earlier in the series, the amount of work that it's almost an 18-month presidency because you're 6 months prepping into it, 6 months doing it, and 6 months helping somebody else to get a handle on it.
Well, one good thing that's emerged too in the recent sometimes is that we now do it in a trio format. So basically the country prior, the country holding, and the country that's to come after in that 18-month framework work together as a troika to make sure there's continuity in agendas and themes. And that I think is much better than perhaps earlier times when it was stop-start every 6 months.
Oh, it makes much more sense, because even in terms of usefully using people's time, it doesn't make sense that the agenda would continually change. Let me ask you one final question, if I can. You're a man with a huge interest in Europe. You've a great love of it, obviously. You've a great belief in it. Crystal ball gaze for me a little. Where do you see Europe going in the next 20, 30 years? And what do you see as Ireland's role within that?
I see Europe... my vision for Europe would be that first of all, there needs to be significant internal reform. The jury is out as to whether Europe has the capacity to initiate and develop that internal reform. I'm impressed in the early days of the Van Rompuy's presidency, and I think I'm hopeful that he will lead in terms of the vital reforms that are required, particularly the social economic side of the equation and the research and scientific endeavour. In terms of Europe will enlarge. And also Europe will become more coherent in terms of how it articulates its position. The big challenge facing Europe will be how it deals with the phenomenon of globalization as it evolves, and also how it finds a place for itself in the context of a dramatically changing world, in terms of younger, larger population-based areas like Asia, Latin America and other areas coming really to the plate in terms of economic power, and how Europe manages to stay competitive and how it manages its relationships with the new powers that will become stronger, no doubt about that, in the coming decades is the key question facing us. But I see Europe as strong, with an effective voice to play and role to play, and has the potential to maintain and sustain the quality of life for its citizens well into the future.
And Ireland's role within Europe, Minister?
Ireland's role within Europe is to bring its own distinctive perspectives as a smaller state, and also the fact that we're a small open economy, to bring that perspective to bear on European economic policy as well, and also the values in terms of foreign policy, in terms of fair play, justice, nuclear disarmament, non-proliferation, commitment to human rights, and basic values like that, that we continue to make sure that they're at centre stage within the European Union.
Sounds like we've a lot of work ahead of us for the coming 20 or 30 years. Minister, thank you for that insight. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome indeed.
You've been listening to 103.2 Dublin City FM. This series was presented and produced by Ellen Gunning. Sound engineering was by David O'Grady. The series was made with the assistance of the Department of Foreign Affairs Communicating Europe Initiative.